जननीं शारदां देवीं रामकृष्णं जगद्गुरुं पादपद्मे तयोश्रित्वा प्रणमामि मुहुर्मुहुः. We take refuge at the feet of Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi and Great Master Sri Ramakrishna. Our salutations to them over and over again. Namah Shri Yati Rajaya Vivekananda Suraye Satchit Sukha Swarupaya Swamine Tapaharine. Salutations to the sage Swami Vivekananda, the king among renouncers, the embodiment of existence, knowledge, bliss absolute, and who removes all our miseries. Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Mrutangamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Oh, peace, peace, peace be unto us, peace be unto all. Friends, I'm very happy to be here once again with you all. And I'm happy to see more new faces this time. As Sukumar Das said, last time it was a brief visit and it was just one lecture, and this time it is a more structured program, and I'm really happy to be with you all, more new faces, and also equally glad to meet familiar faces. So as announced, we will be reflecting on Sadhana Panchakam. Sadhana means spiritual practice. Panchakam means five verses. Five verses on spiritual practices. So different kinds of spiritual practices. This is Sri Shankara's wonderful composition. Five verses. And each verse has eight spiritual practices. So eight multiplied by five, we have 40 spiritual practices, some of which overlap. So we will reflect on these spiritual practices, as many of them as we can during these 3 days, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. But before we dwell on these verses proper, it will not be out of place to see what is meant by spiritual life. Because spiritual practice, spiritual disciplines, spiritual life, We are all familiar with this, and we try to live a spiritual life in our own humble way. But it is good to reflect on certain core aspects of spiritual life. According to Vedanta, which means according to the Upanishads go by the name Vedanta. According to Vedanta, we are all essentially the spirit. We are all essentially divine. We are not what we appear to be for others, or what we mistake ourselves to be most of the time. We are not this body, we are not this mind. Most of the time we are one with the mind, one with the body. We look upon ourselves as limited individuals, and we are aware of the problems, the state of bondage we are in, and we struggle in our own way for freedom. But we have a sense of limitedness. We, the spirit, associated with body and mind. Mind first and then body. Usually we are taught to meditate on God in the heart, inside of us. This inside and outside is based on the body, that is the dividing area. When you say God outside of us, God inside of us, inside and outside is defined by the body. When we look upon ourselves as the body, which is how we begin our spiritual life, we visualize God as luminous, seated in our hearts, and we repeat the name corresponding to that particular form of God. And we, as we do this steadfastly, despite mental resistance, we grow in purity, and by God's grace, He reveals Himself in our heart. That is spiritual life. But we are taught to meditate on God within. But we need to remember that though this is the teaching, we meditate on God within, that is based on the premise that we are the body. We look upon ourselves as the body. But Vedanta makes one thing very clear. We are essentially the spirit. Whether we are aware of it or not, that doesn't matter. That we are not aware of the fact that we are essentially the spirit does not undermine the truth that we are the spirit. So we are the spirit, we are the Atman, that's the name Vedanta gives. Or let's say we are divine. Somehow, we don't know when, this spirit came to be associated with the mind. And the mind has a body outside of it. And this spirit, which we are, has been thinking that it is the body, it is the mind, it is a limited individual. So we are essentially the spirit. We have put on a mental body, which is the mind, over which we have put on a physical body. These are two vestments. But unfortunately, we think we are these vestments. We put on a shirt, we put on a coat. It is as much a fallacy as to think, I am the shirt, I am the coat. So Vedanta says, we are essentially the spirit. So a spiritual seeker considers the spirit to be fundamental, divinity to be fundamental, and he or she understands that the mind and the body are manifestations of the spirit. Just as we are essentially the spirit, the universe of names and forms that we see outside, everything is real to us. That is also essentially the spirit. Though it appears different, we see men, women, tall, short, black, white, from this country, that country, all of which are body-based differences. We see all these differences, but essentially Vedanta says that what exists is the spirit. Outside, inside, we saw already, outside is with reference to the body. So as long as I am identified with my body, identified with my mind, I am taught to meditate on God within, and I do meditate, and I am taught to serve others as best I can. I am taught to do work as worship. All this gradually brings forth the divinity that is hidden in me. I begin to more and more become aware that I am the spirit, and I begin to grow more and more in detachment from my body and my mind, which means I grow strong in the will, I grow in self-mastery, and I begin to tap higher levels of happiness, much superior to the happiness that comes from the organic level of our being, which is sensory happiness. So this is the first point. A spiritual seeker considers spirit to be fundamental and matter as a manifestation of the spirit. Materialists, on the other hand, will consider matter to be fundamental, anything that is perceivable by the senses to be fundamental, and they try to interpret subtle things in terms of what is already known, which is matter. There are scientists who say that the mind, the thoughts in the mind, are nothing but some kind of a secretion by the brain. The brain can be seen when you cut open a dead body. So they try to interpret thoughts in terms of brain, just as the pancreas secrete insulin. The brain is supposed to secrete thoughts. And a still finer subtle secretion is consciousness, according to materialists, who consider matter to be fundamental and try to interpret anything that transcends matter as in terms of matter. But Vedanta is just the opposite. So Vedanta and science and religion, this is the basic difference. A Vedantin, a devotee, can be scientific in that he observes things, he collects data, and he does the experiment himself. And this experiment is not outside in a lab, but it's in the lab called the mind, using reagents called the mind. So we do the experiment in our own mind, scientifically. Because there have been spiritual scientists like Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Krishna, who tell us, you perform this experiment with your mind, you plumb the depths of your own mind, and you will discover the truth within. So there are spiritual scientists who have laid down details of experiments. perform this experiment under controlled conditions and you will realize the truth. You will get the end product. So if you are scientists, considering matter to be fundamental, we perform experiments as scientists want us to perform and we get the end result. So we can be scientific in our attitude when we practice religion, when we follow the teachings of these spiritual scientists who say that God exists. Sri Ramakrishna practiced several pathways in Hinduism. Of course, by sheer longing, vyakulata, yearning for God, he had the vision of the Divine Mother. We all know from his biography. He had a vision of the Divine Mother as as an ocean of consciousness. Waves and waves of consciousness were coming to him. The waves engulfed him and he became one with the waves. So it was a unique experience. And after that, Sri Ramakrishna practiced sadhana according to different pathways in Hinduism. Gurus came to Sri Ramakrishna to orient him in these practices. And in every one of these practices, Sri Ramakrishna attained perfection in just 3 days. But then one of our senior teachers, Swami teachers in Belur Math, Swami Mukhyanandaji, who is no more, he died a couple of years back in his 90s. He was one of our very inspiring teachers. So he would say, when we say Sri Ramakrishna realized this in 3 days, that sadhana, that he realized perfection through that sadhana in 3 days, this sadhana in 3 days, it means 12 years plus 3 days, 12 years plus 3 days. Because we see 12 long years of sadhana, Sri Ramakrishna, by just sheer dint of his vyakulata, longing. So he was a spiritual scientist. Sri Aurobindo, the great mystic who lived in the 20th century, said that Sri Ramakrishna ransacked the kingdom of God with the violence of his love. Something like that. I'm not reproducing it verbatim, but Sri Ramakrishna ransacked the kingdom of God violently, something like that. That means Sri Ramakrishna had that quest, continuous quest, and God kept on revealing himself to him in his infinite dimensions. So that is a spiritual scientist. So as devotees, as spiritual seekers, we hold the spirit to be fundamental and we can be scientific. Though we don't consider matter to be fundamental, we can be scientific in our attitude. That means we are steadfast in our spiritual practice. We pin our faith, called Shraddha, in the teachings of scriptures and of realized souls and of incarnations of God, like Sri Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna. Because teachings about the spirit, we are not the body, we are not the mind, we are the spirit. And this world is not material, there is spirit behind it. It is the spirit that appears to us as this matter. And there is God. God can be prayed to. You pray to God, as long as it is sincere, God does respond to your prayer. That is Sri Ramakrishna's teaching. So teachings about the realm of the spirit, we have to get from realized souls, incarnations of God, or the scriptures, the Upanishads. The Upanishads are nothing but records of spiritual experiences of seers, rishis, who are spiritual scientists. They plumb the depths of their own mind and discover the truth that they are the spirit. So having this faith, a firm conviction that the teachings of the scriptures and of realized souls are true, that is what is called Shraddha, says Sri Shankaracharya in his Viveka Chudamani. Shastreshu Guru Vakyeshu Satya Buddhi Avadharanam. Satya Buddhi, a firm conviction. Buddhi stands for conviction, determination, decision making, practicing discrimination. Buddhi is a very important word in Sanskrit. And the intellect is a very inadequate translation. When you have to translate it, you have a word. But the intellect hardly brings out any of the dimensions of the word Buddhi. So Satya Buddhi Avadharanam, a firm conviction that the teachings of the scriptures and of a realized soul are true. That is what is called Shraddha. So we need such teachings about the realm of the spirit, and this Shraddha helps us remain steadfast in our spiritual practice. We don't need the scriptures for sensory experiences. Fire is hot. Stick your finger inside, you know it is hot. You don't need the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad to tell you that. Ice is cold. Place your hand on a block of ice, you know it is cold. We don't need the Kathopanishad to teach us that. But we need these Upanishads to tell us, you are not the body, you are not the mind, you are the spirit. You mistakenly think that you are the body. That's what the Upanishads teach, the realized souls teach. God is there, God can be prayed to, you can grow in devotion to God. So we pin our faith. Faith again is an inadequate word to translate Shraddha. Shraddha is dynamic, faith is static. Faith is, I believe in God. What do I do about that belief? I believe in God, okay, but I go about my life in the same old beaten track. So that faith hardly translates into action, that hardly translates into transformation of character. So faith again is an inadequate word for Shraddha. Shraddha is dynamic. Shraddha, we saw oneness, according to Sri Shankara, a firm conviction that the teachings of the scriptures and of the Guru of a realized soul are true. Swami Vivekananda gives an example to describe Shraddha. He says, imagine a thief in a room, locked up in a room, adjacent to which is another room full of rare, precious jewels. And this thief is aware of the fact that there is wealth in the adjacent room, and both the rooms are separated only by a wall. So what will be the mindset of the thief? He's all the time aware of the wealth in the adjacent room. So he's aware of the goal. And he knows the obstacle is this wall. So he will spend all his time, he'll bend all his energies in thinking of how to demolish the wall and make the wealth his own. And he doesn't rest quiet. And he doesn't stop until he has realized the goal. Swami Vivekananda says similarly, a spiritual seeker who is aware of the wealth within, that he is divine, God is the wealth within. That means there is goal orientation of the mind. The mind is oriented toward the senses, senses toward the objects. So we are outward directed. But when we are endowed with Shraddha, we are goal oriented. We are oriented toward the goal, though the goal may not be real now. As we saw, we have faith in the teachings of the scriptures and of realized souls. There is goal orientation, and the Shraddha will keep on inspiring our thoughts and actions until we realize the goal. So Shraddha is dynamic. When we are endowed with Shraddha, we don't need oversight. We don't need supervision by people. How much of japa you did today? How long did you meditate today? How long you while away your time today? No one needs to ask us. If you are endowed with Shraddha, we are motivated people. And we can motivate ourselves. When we have Shraddha, whatever we do, we will do well. And whatever be the time we are able to give to spiritual practices, we will do it to the best of our ability. No one needs to keep tabs on us. Oh, no one is asking me how much japa you did. No one needs to ask us if you are endowed with Shraddha. So Shraddha is required for these truths about the spirit, spiritual realm. And spiritual life, what is spiritual life? What do we try to do as spiritual seekers? One is, we consider spirit to be fundamental and matter to be an accretion on the spirit. And we try to look upon ourselves as the spirit. And how does it translate? Spirit is a word, right? Atman is a word. Brahman is a word. So looking upon ourselves as the spirit, what does it mean? Good to hear. But what does it mean? How does it translate into practice? I am an entity different from the body, different from the mind. This makes sense. This makes sense when we have a spiritual ideal to struggle for, and our mind doesn't let us struggle. We want to do japa, the mind doesn't let us do it. We still do it. We are caught in the vortex of thoughts of the mind, and we try to do our spiritual practice, and we want to cultivate a good habit. The mind doesn't let us. We want to give up some bad habit. Good, bad, again, relative terms, but we know what is good, what is bad. So we need to give up some bad habit, so we are not able to give it up. Then we understand that we are an entity held captive by the mind and the senses. And the mind is something that doesn't help me. The mind is something that doesn't cooperate with me. The mind is acting against my interest. The mind is my enemy. Then we know by first-hand experience that we are different from the mind. So we need to assert ourselves against the mind. I am different from the mind. I am an entity different from the mind. And we can add some devotion to it. I am a child of God. I am a spark of the divine fire. The divine fire, the light of all lights, which is our true nature, which we truly are. I am a spark of the divine fire. Fire has the capacity to burn things. And so has a spark of fire. A spark of fire has as much burning power as fire itself. So as a spark of the divine fire, as an aspect of God, as part of God, I am pure, I am strong, I am infinite. So that's the idea. A spiritual seeker looks upon himself or herself as an entity different from the body, different from the mind. And every time the mind says no to whatever we are trying to do that is beneficial to us, we don't listen to the mind, we go about doing what is beneficial to us. By first-hand experience, we understand that we are different from the mind. This cannot come by spiritual, this cannot come by scholarship, this cannot come by PhD in philosophy, this cannot come by anything else, scholarship. We have to do what we believe is right, what we believe is beneficial to us, what will help us manifest our hidden divinity, despite mental resistance. Only then do we understand we are different from the mind. When we are steadfast in our spiritual practice, without waiting for approval from our mind, we know we are an entity different from the mind. So a spiritual seeker tries to do this, tries to do what is beneficial to him or her. And when we do it, we live truly a spiritual life. When we look upon ourselves as the spirit, we begin to think differently, we begin to act differently, we become better people. We bring out more and more of our hidden divinity. We grow in self-mastery. Sri Swami Vivekananda says, if a student thinks he is the spirit, he becomes a better student. If a lawyer thinks he is the spirit, he becomes a better lawyer. If a fisherman thinks he is the spirit, he becomes a better fisherman. That means we become better persons. So spiritual life involves in looking upon ourselves as the spirit. And we don't take for granted whatever the world offers. We try to penetrate deeper. We don't try to judge people based on their appearances. If he's of this color, he has to be like this. If he's from this country, he has to be like this. So we try to, when we look upon ourselves as the spirit, we grant it to others also. He's not just this body. He's not what he appears to be from outside. But he's something deeper within. So how does it translate into practice? I stop judging people based on their externals, based on their exterior. I rather focus on myself. But our mind and the senses are directed outward. The mind is directed outward toward the senses, ears, skin, eyes, tongue, and the nose. And these sense organs always are eager to come in contact with their respective sense objects. And that's how human personality is created. The Kathopanishad says, the Creator inflicted an injury, as it were, on human beings by creating the senses and the mind outward. That is why people are outward directed. We know more about others than about ourselves. He's like this, she's like this. I'm the yardstick for the world. I judge others. And I speak about them to others. That is gossip. And a gossiping mind and spiritual life are absolutely incompatible. Both cannot coexist. A spiritual seeker has no room for gossip. He doesn't pry into others' affairs. And even if something comes to him passively, he or she doesn't take notice of it. We need to remember Holy Mother's teachings. Don't see faults in others, learn to see your own faults. That's what a spiritual seeker does. He doesn't look for perfection outside. He seeks perfection within. The world cannot be perfect. We've come to this world We have come to this world not for enjoyment, though this body, by the ignorant, is looked upon as an instrument for enjoyment. This body is a precious instrument for spiritual practice. And we are in this world to do our duties, to face our problems. So when we work in the right earnest and in the right way in the world, that helps bring out our hidden divinity. It makes us stronger. So there's another important point. As a spiritual seeker, what's our attitude toward the world? Do we think that because we are devoted to God, we should be exempt from problems of the world? Some people think, I've been devoted for a long time, I've been practicing spiritual discipline for a long time, yet there doesn't seem to be any end to my problems, one calamity after another. So there are people who give up their devotions and, what is the alternative? We become devoted to the world, which is the default condition. And we can give it a try. What does the world bring? The world brings only misery. It brings misery and happiness. We get happiness, no doubt. We don't want misery. But happiness always alternates with misery in the world. And ultimately, if something is a source of happiness for me today, it's proved to me tomorrow, when I grow in discriminatory wisdom, I understand that the same thing is a source of misery for me. Something is a source of happiness for me today. Tomorrow it's proved to be a source of misery. So ultimately, for a spiritual seeker, things in the world will ultimately lead him only to misery. It doesn't make us pessimistic. That's the truth. So he begins to seek that happiness which does not alternate with misery. And that happiness is our true nature. That supreme bliss transcends both happiness and misery, which are part of the world. So this world is a mixture of happiness and misery. And the spiritual seeker understands that he or she will not get to live in a sanitized world because he or she is devoted to God. I will continue to live in the same world of pairs of opposites, praise and blame, success, failure, happiness, misery. In fact, more of these negative things. But these pairs of opposites lose their sting on me because of my devotion to God. The more devoted I am to God, the more insulated I become from misery. So I continue to live in the world. I will have my own quota of misery, devoted to God or not. So this is one understanding which is very important. As spiritual seekers, we don't expect to live in a sanitized world. There will be good and bad, pairs of opposites. There will be difficult people difficult to deal with. But I try to hold on to the spirit within, hold on to the mantra. That's what it translates to. So our attitude toward the world and our attitude toward God, that's also is very important. First we saw attitude toward ourselves. We are the spirit. We are a spark of the divine fire. Attitude toward others, they are also sparks of the divine fire. They are also children of God. So I stop judging them. I try to reflect on my own faults. I try to strengthen my own character. Then we saw about the world. This world is a training ground. Swami Vivekananda says, this world is a grand moral gymnasium where we have all come to make ourselves strong. We go to the gym for workout, and at the end of the workout, we don't see how much of wear and tear is there in the weights that we used for the exercise. We see how strong our biceps have become, how strong our body, different parts of the body have become. So this world is going to be as it is, it's going to be a mixture of pairs of opposites. So we cannot transform the world, but we can transform ourselves. So this is a moral gymnasium, this world. In this gymnasium, we don't worry about the changes we have effected on the world, but we have to examine ourselves, how strong we have become in this training ground. So that's an important point. This world is a training ground. This world is a precious place. This human birth is a very rare birth, because only in this birth can we think about God, can we practice discrimination between what is right, what is wrong. Only in this human body can we realize God. It's not possible in a subhuman body. And our attitude toward God. What is God? Any teaching that contains the word God in it, our comprehension of that teaching will depend upon our comprehension of God. By God, what do we mean? That will determine my understanding of any teaching that has God in it. Vedanta says God is all-pervading. Reality is one. My essential nature is the divinity. And when I realize that I am divine, I understand that the divinity behind this human being, behind this human frame, and the divinity behind the universe are one and the same. Tat Tvam Asi. Or I am Atma Brahma. That's another Mahavakya. So God with form, our personal God, is called in Vedanta technically Ishvara. Ishvara here does not mean Shiva. Ishvara means personal God. Ishvara is that absolute God seen through the human mind. God reveals himself to us in different forms as suited to our temperaments. Swami Vivekananda says, personal God is the highest rating of the absolute by the human mind. Swami Vivekananda was known for his clarity. You don't have this definition anywhere else. The highest rating of the absolute reality by the human mind. If we look at the sun with black colored glasses, someone does it with blue, brown, green. So someone sees a brown sun, blue sun, green sun, black sun. It's all the same sun seen through these glasses. So it will be futile and foolish to fight in the name of the colors. Black sun is the only sun I know, I have seen with my glasses. Blue sun is equally true. So it is the sun seen through our glasses. So the absolute reality seen through our mind makes us worship God, endowed with a particular form, God or Goddess. That is about personal God, Ishvara, the Creator. Then you have incarnations, incarnations of God. Sri Krishna, Sri Ramakrishna, according to Hinduism, traditional Hinduism, there is what is called Dashavatar, 10 incarnations. But the Gita says, the Gita does not limit the number of incarnations to 10. It says, whenever there is a decline of dharma, whenever there is an ascent of vice, I assume myself a body to uphold dharma. This is Sri Krishna's teaching in the Gita. So there is no limit. There is no limit to the number of times that Supreme Reality can assume a human form, or any form for that matter. So God can incarnate only once for all time to come, worship him, go to heaven, or go to the other side. That's alien to Vedanta. Vedanta says, God is infinite, and he can manifest himself in infinite different ways. Sri Ramakrishna says, you cannot limit God. Iti kora jayana in Bengali. You cannot say iti with respect to God. Iti in Sanskrit means thus, so far. Iti means it's over. You have in the Gita, at the end of every chapter, Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita-su, Upanishad-su, Brahma Vidyaya, Yoga Shastre, Sri Krishna Arjuna Sambhade, Sankhya Yoga Nama, Dvitiyo Dhyayaha. So Iti means it's complete. Sri Ramakrishna says, you can never set limits to God. You can never say God can only be this and not anything more. When you set limits to the infinite, you make it finite. So Sri Ramakrishna says you cannot set limits to the infinite. So a devotee, a true devotee, tries to understand this. God can manifest himself in any number of ways. I have a particular way. That is not the way for everyone. I should have faith. I should have steadfastness. What is called ishtanishta, to my spiritual ideal. And I give the freedom to others too. So it's not that you worship God only through this form, you're going to reach the goal, and others are not going to reach the goal. Sri Ramakrishna used to ask this question frequently. Do you believe in God with form or without form? And if someone said, M said in a second meeting, you find in the gospel, I would like to believe in God without form. Sri Ramakrishna said, very good, hold fast to that belief. But don't for a moment think that alone is true. that those who are worshipping God with form are committing a mistake. Just hold fast to what you think is true. God himself has instituted different forms of worship to suit different temperaments, capacities of spiritual seekers. As a mother cooks different dishes from the fish that she gets in the market, different dishes to suit different digestive capacities of her children. So these are certain important points in our spiritual life. And Swami Vivekananda's famous teaching, we are all potentially divine, and the goal is to manifest this divinity within by controlling nature, external and internal. Do this by work or worship or psychic control or philosophy, by one or more or all of these, and be free. This is the whole of religion. Control external nature and internal nature. More important, internal nature, our own mind, our own mindset. That is internal nature. I have my own prejudices, I have my own likes, dislikes. So controlling my own internal nature, and do this, accomplish this control by work, karma yoga, worship, bhakti yoga, psychic control, raja yoga, and discrimination, jnana yoga, knowledge, jnana yoga, by one or more or all of these. Swami Vivekananda says, one of these four temperaments is predominant in our personality: the active temperament, the emotional temperament, the meditative temperament, and the philosophical temperament. These are not watertight compartments. All of us have these temperaments. Most of us are active. That is why karma yoga, work as spiritual discipline, is the inevitable first step in spiritual life. Karma yoga, doing work as worship, goes to strengthen our will, detach our will from desire, and orients us toward God when we combine devotion with karma yoga. Swami Vivekananda himself speaks of two kinds of karma yoga in his lectures on karma yoga. Work for work's sake. I don't need to believe in God. I don't need to believe in any metaphysical doctrines. Just work. I shall be detached. I shall be selfless and work. You will reach the same goal that a yogi who sits in meditation in a cave realizes. And Swami Vivekananda held Buddha to be the exemplar of this kind of karma yoga. He didn't care for metaphysical doctrines. He said, there is misery, try to alleviate that misery. Be good. We know his eightfold path, which includes concentration, meditation. But yeah, that is preceded by a number of ethical disciplines. So, the idea is to strengthen the mind, is to culture the mind, and to manifest our hidden divinity through karma yoga, bhakti yoga, raja yoga, yoga of meditation, or jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge. So active, emotional, meditative, and philosophical. These are the four temperaments. It was Swamiji's genius that he divided humanity into these four kinds. And each yoga suits these four different temperaments. And as we saw, these are not watertight compartments. We have all of these. So we practice all the four yogas. Swami Vivekananda said, I consider that person fully integrated in whom all the four temperaments, all the four yogas find equal manifestation. We try to do japa, japa is bhakti yoga, we sing bhajans, bhakti yoga, we try to meditate, raja yoga, we try to do selfless work, karma yoga. We also try to practice discrimination. God alone is true and this world is fleeting. Sri Ramakrishna gave this teaching not just to his monastic disciples. He gave these teachings to householder disciples who came to him on Sundays and other holidays. He says, you need to reflect on the fact that God alone is true. Everything else is fleeting. This world is ephemeral. You need to practice this discrimination, especially when you're about to be overcome by lust or anger. You find this in the Gospel. So spiritual seeker, householder, single, or monk. If we are spiritual seekers, if we look forward to some spiritual experience, Sri Ramakrishna says, giving up is essential. Whatever station of life we are in, we have our duties to perform, but there are certain conditions to be fulfilled. We find them all in the gospel. So, we look upon ourselves as the spirit, we have a clear idea that God, that point I didn't elaborate, that one point we elaborate, and then we begin with the verses. God is present everywhere. Vishnu means Vyapakatvat Vishnu. Vishnu means all-pervading. There is another name for God, Vibhu. Vibhu also means all-pervading. So there is nowhere where God is not. Only God exists. Anything else is an appearance. Once again, an example. Advaita Vedanta says, you see a rope during twilight. There is darkness, insufficient light. You mistake the rope for a snake. And as long as you see snake in that rope, you have all the fear and trepidation associated with witnessing a snake. But when you shine a flashlight on the object, the rope stands revealed for what it is. The snake didn't appear, the snake didn't disappear, but it was true to us. So Vedanta says, this world is nothing but Brahman. It appears to us as this world of diversity because of darkness, of ignorance, of the fact that we are the spirit. But when we realize that we are the light of all lights, we are the Atman, this world, we don't see this world as world anymore, but we see Brahman. We see only the spirit. Sri Ramakrishna says, I see this world drenched in consciousness, just as a road can be drenched in water on a rainy day. So that was his experience. So God is all-pervading, but he is especially present in the hearts of human beings. Sri Ramakrishna's example, a landlord can be found anywhere in his vast property, but he is especially present in the parlor where he receives visitors. What a wonderful example. God's being present especially in the hearts of human beings doesn't nullify the fact that he is all-pervading. A landlord can be found anywhere in his property. So God is all-pervading, but he is especially present in the hearts of human beings. That's why we are taught to meditate on God as consciousness, as luminous, that luminosity endowed with a form to suit our temperament. But that helps to internalize the mind. And God is someone very close to us. Sri Ramakrishna says we should establish a definite relationship with God. And God as the mother, and ourselves as his child, her child, God as mother. He says that is the purest attitude possible. So we establish a definite relationship with God, and we try to be God-loving, not God-fearing. God-fearing is it's in common parlance, used in common parlance. He's a God-fearing man. In the sense that if I go astray, God will punish me. If I do well, God will bless me. This attitude is good as far as it goes. As long as this strengthens the moral fiber of people, so be it. God will punish me if I go astray. If it helps people grow in morality, fine. But a spiritual seeker transcends this attitude. God is not someone waiting there to settle scores with me after death. He doesn't say, he's not waiting there to say, oh, you did this wrong, you did this mistake, so calculate every one of them and you're consigned to that place. These are all crude human concepts superimposed on God because of our own limitations. God is all love. God lets us play in this world. God lets us play. As long as we are satisfied with what this play brings, God lets us play. God is in no great hurry to wean us from this play and direct us toward himself. Sri Ramakrishna's example. The mother lets the child play with its toys and she is busy in the kitchen. When the child is done with the toys, it doesn't derive any pleasure from the toys. It throws away the toys and cries, mother. The mother comes running. takes the child on her lap and begins to nurse the child. Similarly, God, the mother, lets us play with the toys of the world, our possessions, animate toys, inanimate toys. As long as we are happy with that game, with that play, God lets us play. But we have a little freedom, whether to wean ourselves from the play, turn to God, or continue with the play. So we have that little freedom. And to the extent we exercise this freedom in the right direction, more of this freedom is added to us. Sri Ramakrishna again gives an example. A cow is tied to a post, and let's say with a rope of 20 feet radius, so it can graze that circle of grass defined by this radius. But the cow thinks, I'm tied to this post, what is so big fun in just grazing this particular area? I would graze if I were completely free. The cow doesn't do anything, just meekly sits quiet. So it continues to sit quiet, nothing happens to it. And it deprives itself of whatever grass it can feast on. But if the cow finishes grazing this particular circle defined by this 20 feet, the cowherd comes, releases the cow. He probably increases the radius of the rope, or perhaps lets the cow completely free. You find this in the Great Master. I don't think you get it in the Gospel. Great Master, you have. Similarly, says Sri Ramakrishna, we have a little freedom. If we exercise that freedom in the right direction, God gives us more freedom. If we channel our thoughts and actions in the right direction, God helps us, God gives us more strength to struggle and exercise that in the right direction. So God is all love. He's not an agent waiting to take it out on us, but He is ready to respond to us. He is equally disposed toward everyone, the Gita. This teaching is also important. Because we'll have to set the basis for these five verses. We have to get certain fundamentals very clear. This important fundamental is, God doesn't have favorites. Does God have chosen few to bless or to punish? God doesn't have chosen few. Sri Krishna says in the Gita, Samoham sarva bhuteshu name dveshyosti na priya. I am equally disposed toward everyone. I have no objects of hatred. I have no objects of love. Then the next line is very important. E bhajanti tu mam bhaktya mayite teshu chapyaham. I am equally disposed toward everyone. I don't have objects of hatred. I don't have objects of love. But those who worship me with devotion, they abide in me and I abide in them. So God is equally disposed toward everyone. In other words, God's grace is on everyone. And we realize it. We realize the presence of God's grace in our own humble lives in proportion to our struggle. When we unfold the sails of a sailboat, the boat is able to benefit from the wind velocity. As long as the sails are tight, the boat doesn't benefit from the wind. So we need to struggle to be aware of God's grace in our lives. Those who worship me with devotion, they abide in me and I abide in them. Sri Shankaracharya gives a beautiful explanation in his commentary. He says, fire gives us warmth. It won't do to say fire gives us warmth and continue to feel cold. How does fire give us warmth? When we approach fire. When you approach fire, you feel the warmth of fire. So God is equally disposed toward everyone. God is gracious to everyone. We become aware of God's grace on our lives as we approach God. Take one step toward God, God takes 100 steps toward you, Sri Ramakrishna. So that one step is inevitable. Self-effort is inevitable. There is no substitute for self-effort. But the more we exert ourselves, the more we begin to be aware that we are not alone in our struggle against the mind, against the world. We are aware of God's help. We are aware of God's presence in our lives. And that's the only way to know that. So this sadhana panchakam, it's now 8:15. How long do we go? We can do one thing. We'll start with sadhana panchakam. Maybe today, if there is no time, we'll leave out question answers.
Okay.
But we'll start the subject. Yes. Maybe okay. Go on till 8:45 or so.
Sure. Hmm? Yeah.
Right. We can have questions from the next session.
Sure.
Because we have to set the stage and have this preamble. Yes. So this Sadhana Panchakam, 5 verses on sadhanas, spiritual practices. Each of these verses has 8 teachings. So we'll reflect on these practices one by one. The first practice is Vedo Nityam Adhiyatam. That means study the Vedas regularly. That means study scriptural teachings, spiritual teachings regularly. Nityam Adhiyatam. That means make scriptural readings a part of your spiritual practice. This is an important sadhana for a spiritual seeker. Study of scriptures, study of the Upanishads, study of the Bhagavad Gita. For devotees of Sri Ramakrishna, study of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, study of Holy Mother's Gospel, study of Swami Vivekananda's teachings. For practical spiritual life, to derive inspiration, Mahapurush Maharaj's conversations, for seekers of God, Eternal Companion, Swami Brahmananda's teachings, spiritual treasures, letters of Swami Turiyananda. These are all perennial sources of inspiration. Because when we study these teachings, we inspire ourselves with, we orient ourselves to the goal, and we inspire ourselves with, to we derive inspiration for our spiritual practices. Because during the day, the mind gathers so much of dirt, and at the end of the day, we could feel exhausted, and we may not have time, we may not have the energy to do our spiritual practice. But when we study the scriptures regularly, study these spiritual teachings regularly, our mind once again gets oriented to the spiritual goal. We try to do howsoever little, we try not to see that our spiritual practice is the casualty. We try to do whatever we can. So scriptural studies regularly as a part of our spiritual practice helps orient the mind toward the goal, and it provides us inspiration for spiritual practice. So obviously, scholarship is not the goal for spiritual seekers. Spiritual seekers study scriptures to strengthen their convictions, says Swami Vivekananda. They don't study scriptures for argumentation or engaging people in debate. All that phase is long gone, Swami Vivekananda says. He says a spiritual seeker studies the scriptures to strengthen his conviction, to derive strength for spiritual practice. Otherwise, dry scholarship, there's no dearth of such people. People who are who have mastery in the 6 systems of Indian philosophy, Upanishads, they can hold forth for hours together, and they're heads of departments of philosophy. But how much of their scholarship has had a transforming effect on their character? That's a big question. 9 to 5, they can be professors of Vedanta. 5 to 9, what they are is a different question. That 5 to 9, what we are, determines whether scriptural studies is for scholarship or for transformation of character. 9 to 5 is for earning our bread. And if 5 to 9 is only the manifestation of our animal nature, it doesn't help. I may have PhDs, I may have the capacity to guide people on their ways to their PhDs, but that is different. That is what Sri Ramakrishna calls dry scholarship, Bhagavata Pandit. Bhagavata Pandit, you find in the Gospel, Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. A scholar in the Bhagavata used to go to the kingdom and give lessons on the Bhagavata to the king. And at the end of every lesson, he would ask the king, "O king, have you understood?" Maybe in a very, not in a very egotistic way, but he wanted to make sure that the lessons he gave on that day was comprehended well by the king. The king would say, "You better understand the scripture yourself first." The scholar couldn't really understand what the king said, but he could not contradict the king, because he wanted to He wanted to give lessons to the king, and that was a means of his livelihood. And he continued to give lessons to the king every time he would go. And at the end of the day, "O king, have you understood?" The king would say, you better understand the scripture yourself first. So the Pandit reflected on this again and again, and finally understood that the Bhagavata teaches, love God, give up everything else, give up your attachment to fleeting things. So the Pandit understood, and then he renounced the world then and there, and sent word to the king, "O king, I have now understood." So the scriptures teach that God alone is real. But mere scholarship doesn't help us. So we don't study the scriptures for scholarship. Sri Ramakrishna's example, the almanac predicts so many inches of rains. Squeeze the almanac, not a drop of water comes out. So the scripture says, cultivate devotion to God. Sri Ramakrishna gives another example. A person sent a shopping list to his friend, procured these things, 1, 2, 3, 4. And once he saw the shopping list and registered all those things in his mind, he went about procuring things. He didn't need the list anymore. So the scriptures are nothing but a shopping list. Do this, cultivate devotion to God, all this, and we go about doing it. But we have to read it over and over again because the shopping list is not registered very clearly in the mind. We need to remind ourselves of the shopping list. We need to procure this, cultivate this devotion. Do your spiritual practice, and we study the life of holy men, and feel more devotion in our own mind. That kindles devotion in our own mind. So scriptural studies are to reflect on the fact that God alone is real, and this world unreal. We don't leave the world and go anywhere else. We are in the world, but our attitude toward the world changes. We try to reflect on the fact that God is real. So we try to focus on what we need to do, but we are not overwhelmed by events, by anything in the world, when we gradually practice this. We need to take everything seriously. We need to take our duty seriously. We need to do the best we can under the circumstances. But once we have done it, Sri Krishna says, don't worry about the future. Mate sangostu akarmani. That means don't be attached to inaction. But he says, karmanyeva adhikaraste ma phaleshu kadachana. Don't be attached to the fruits of action, which means don't dwell in the future as you are in the present, discharging your work. How will be the outcome? Don't be worrying about that when you have to focus yourself on the means. When you have to focus on the means, don't think about the end. Swami Vivekananda says, with the means taken care of all right, the end must come. So we try to conserve our mental energies. Our mental energy, which is frittered away by this useless anxiety, fear, worry, born of thinking about uncertain future, can be avoided, this waste of energy, by focusing on the present. So we live in the world, we take our duty seriously, we do the best we can, and then leave it to God. One of the senior Swamis used to say, he said there are two principles in Karma Yoga. When he's a senior Swami, and I had once occasion to go on a drive with him from Coimbatore to Ooty, 2.5 hours away. In Ooty also we have a wonderful ashram. So in the course of our conversation, he mentioned two important principles in Karma Yoga. Work as worship. He said, take everything seriously. That means whatever you need to do, put your whole mind on it. No cutting corners, no slipshod work, no absent-minded work. Do everything seriously. First principle. Second principle, don't take anything seriously. These are apparently contradictory things. But don't take anything seriously means after you've done your part, don't take everything seriously. Yeah. Don't worry about things. Yeah. Someone has said something, you fell into a misunderstanding with someone, some event happened. The mind's tendency is to brood on these things. So leave the world alone. The world is fleeting, ephemeral. You have your duties in the world. Do the best you can under the circumstances and then forget. Try to turn the mind toward God than letting the mind dwell on everything else. So take everything seriously. Don't take anything seriously. Apparently contradictory things. But we cannot afford to follow only the second to the exclusion of the first. that'll make us and keep us tamasic. Tamasic is inert. Tamas is defined by excessive attachment to sleep, more than what is required, laziness, and a tendency to postpone things. Don't postpone anything to tomorrow if it can be done on the day after. That's the idea. People who want to postpone things. So these are all traits of tamas. So if you take the second teaching first, don't take anything seriously, we tend to be tamasic. If you want to grow in sattva, take everything seriously. Do the best you can, give your best shot, and don't take anything seriously. That way, we try to transcend tamas through rajas, cultivating qualities of sattva. We're active, but we stay clear of negative aspects of rajas, like passion, restlessness, worry, anxiety, attachment. So we try to more and more, we try to experience more and more calmness in the midst of activity. Calmness in the midst of activity is sattva. Sattva stands for purity. Sattva stands for calmness. In tamas, we have dullness due to excessive sleep and piously wishing that problems will take care of themselves with passage of time. Nothing happens. The problem gets complicated with passage of time and stares us in the face and then says, I continue to be yours. That is tamas. So we need to address our problems, address our situations in the best way we can. And that's the only way to manifest rajas and do it as worship, offer it to God, so we grow in sattva. So scriptural study. Scriptural study is essential for a spiritual seeker to grow in devotion to God, to orient the mind toward the spiritual ideal, and to inspire himself with strength for spiritual practice. Swami Premananda asked Swami Vivekananda once in Belur Mar, what will be the good of studying the Vedas? Because this teaching was Vedo Nityam Udhiyatam, study the Vedas regularly. We don't go to the Vedas, Samhita, Aranyakanda, all that. We go to study the Upanishads. Still better, study Swami Vivekananda's interpretation of the Upanishads, which is nothing but his lectures on Jnana Yoga. And Swami Vivekananda said, I have taught nothing but the Upanishads. When we study the Upanishads in the light of Swami Vivekananda's teachings, especially in Jnana Yoga, God in Everything, exposition of Ishavasya Upanishad, Unity in Diversity, Kathopanishad, and you have a couple of more lectures on the Kathopanishad. And Swami Vivekananda said, I have taught nothing but the Upanishads. So Premanandaji asked Swamiji, what will be the good of studying the Vedas? Swami Vivekananda replied, it will kill superstition. It will kill superstition. We'll have clear ideas about spiritual life. And Swami Vivekananda says in one place, this body is a simple superstition. This body itself is a superstition. Swami Vivekananda, again and again, he was never tired of rousing this divinity dormant in every one of us during his more than 3 years of ministry in this country, from 1893 to 1896. 1896 end, he set sail for India. That we are all essentially divine. Swami Vivekananda said, my ideal Indi can be put into a few words, and that is to preach unto mankind their inherent divinity and to make it manifest in every moment of their lives. So preach unto humankind. Swami said mankind, in present day's language, you say humankind, their inherent divinity. We are all divine. We are not men, we are not women, we are all divine. And Swami Vivekananda set for himself this as his goal. This is my ideal in life. So I'm the spirit. I'm not the body, I'm not the mind. This was his single refrain, his lectures, his letters, his conversations, his interviews. This is one single point. Not surprisingly, someone asked him here in this country, repeatedly telling yourself, I am the spirit, I am not the body, I am not the mind, does not amount to some kind of a self-hypnotism? Swami Vivekananda said, we are already hypnotized into believing that we are this body. What we are doing is dehypnotization, not hypnotization. We are already hypnotized into believing that we are this body. And this body is a simple superstition. By telling ourselves we are the spirit, we are dehypnotizing ourselves. So that's an important sadhana. So Swami Vivekananda says here, the Upanishads are the great mine of strength. Therein lies strength enough to invigorate the whole world. The whole world can be vivified, made strong, energized through them. They will call with trumpet voice upon the weak, the miserable, and the downtrodden of all races, all creeds, and all sects to stand on their feet and be free. Freedom, physical freedom, mental freedom, and spiritual freedom are the watchwords of the Upanishads. Swami Vivekananda continues, the duty of the philosopher is to raise you above superstition. Even this world, this body and mind are superstitions. What infinite souls you are, and to be tricked by twinkling stars, it's a shameful condition. You are divinities, the twinkling stars owe their existence to you. This is a reference to astrology. This star, that planet there in this particular position, therefore, that accounts for the bad patch I'm going through. In India, you have the 7.5 years of Shani, Saturn. And they say as long as you are subject to the seven and a half years of Shani's influence, nothing good will work for you. And if we are reconciled to it, we won't exert ourselves because nothing good is going to happen. And it is because of the twinkling stars. When we reconcile ourselves to this fact that because we are under the influence of Shani, Saturn, nothing good is going to happen, then we are depriving ourselves of self-effort and transformation in our lives. I remember when I was in Coimbatore, I was looking after a student's home, one of our hostels. It's a huge educational complex. Yeah. And one of the students living in that student's home was a little poor in grades. And we usually call these parents to discuss their son's performance. And when his father came, the son also was with him. So I told the father, this is his performance, we try to do the best we can, but you have to ensure that he doesn't get money unnecessary to fritter away, and all that, whatever we just tell them. And the father, a simple man, you see how these beliefs go deep into your mind when you've not thought about anything higher. The father said, the astrologer said the other day that my son is passing through this Shani's influence for 7.5 years, and that probably accounts for his failed performance. And this in the presence of the son. So he has got a ratification from his father for his poor performance. And the father is not going to mind. And the son goes scot-free. So this is Swami Vivekananda says, to be tricked by these twinkling stars, it's a shameful condition. You are divinities. The twinkling stars owe their existence to you. Natatra suryo bhati na chandratarakam nema vidyuto bhanti kutoyam agni tameva bhantam anubhanti sarvam tasya bhasa sarvam idam vibhati. Upanishad. There the sun does not shine, nor the stars, nor the moons. What to speak of this mortal fire? It shining, everything else shines. So we are that shining light of all lights. 13th chapter of the Gita. Jyotisham apita jyotihi tamasah paramuchyate jnanam jnyeyam jnanagamyam hridi sarvasya vishtitam. Jyotisham apita jyotihi, that's the light of all lights, that supreme light, that spiritual reality, that one essence, that's the light of all lights, it abides in the hearts of human beings. And that is what is called knowledge. That is what is to be known. Jnana is knowledge. Jnaya is what is to be known. Jnana gamyam, end of all knowledge. All of them are the same because there is no going anywhere. Knowledge, that which is to be known, and the end of knowledge is that light of all lights, that abides in the hearts of human beings. And that light makes the sun shine, the moon shine, stars also shine. So to be tricked by these twinkling stars, that's a shameful condition, says Swami Vivekananda. So a study of the Upanishads, a study of the Bhagavad Gita, a study of these inspiring teachings help us orient our mind toward that spiritual reality, and we inspire ourselves with the need to practice spiritual disciplines. That is the first teaching. Vedo Nityam Adhiyatam. Study the scriptures regularly. And in Sanskrit you call it Swadhyaya. Swadhyaya means study of scriptures. Swadhyaya also means self-study. Swa-adhyayana. Swadhyaya means studying ourselves. When our mind is outgoing, we are able to study others. But when we grow in introspection, we are able to study ourselves. We become more and more conscious of our strengths, of our limitations. We don't venture into something for which we know that we don't have competency. So we are aware of our strength, we are aware of our limitations. The more we are aware of these things, the better are the chances of our strengthening weak links in our character. When we are not aware of it, we continue to be prisoners of circumstances, we continue to be prisoners of our own mind. As the mind dictates, any random desire arising in the mind, we go about fulfilling it, and we remain captives of circumstances, people, possessions, all because of our slavery to the mind. So self-study is also part of this swadhyaya, swa-adhyayana, studying ourselves, growing in introspection. At the end of the day, Holy Mother Shisharada Devi says, practice spiritual disciplines in the morning and evening, and in the evening you get a chance to reflect on the contents of your mind, how your mind has been during the course of the day. If we don't do the spiritual practice, mere study does not help us grow in introspection. Any thought arising in the mind, we try to witness the thought and try to get and let it translate into words or actions only if you are convinced, if it is useful. So we are able to witness our thoughts before the thought is able to rise to the conscious plane. That way we grow in introspection. We try to be more economical in our words. We don't unnecessarily speak. When there is a need to speak, we speak. So self-study is something important. Growing in introspection, and to the extent that we grow in this self-study, we become more and more spiritual. We become more and more. We are able to manifest more and more of our hidden strength. The next teaching, next sadhana. Taduditam karma svanushtiyatam. Follow the teachings of the scriptures. That is the second teaching. Of course, this and the first teaching are, they kind of overlap each other. Study the scriptures and follow the teachings of the scriptures. So most of, our reflection on the first one is applicable to this also. So what's required is assimilation of scriptural teachings. Not just scholarship. We try to follow some teachings, three teachings. Following them in our life is more important than learning scriptures by the rote. There is an interesting story about this assimilation. Assimilation of teachings, not just just committing texts to memory. Swami Vivekananda says, education is not the amount of information that is thrust into your brain and runs right there. We want man-making, character-making, assimilation of ideas. Assimilation of ideas, that should be the core of education, according to Swami Vivekananda. I read this story long back and saw how admirably it illustrates the need to assimilate teachings, not just learn them by the rote. There is a forest, and there is a small hermitage, and there is a holy man. And in the forest there are so many different kinds of birds, and there is a parrot which used to perch on the branch of the tree close to this hermitage. And hunters used to visit that area where there are a good number of birds. And hunters would spread their net and then throw some grains, and the birds would come to peck at those grains, and then they would fold the net and then and carry these birds. That was what was happening. So this holy man, the sadhu, he developed a fascination for this parrot which was perching on the tree close to his ashram. So he thought he would teach this parrot to save itself from the lures of the hunter, to save its life. So he taught this parrot, "The hunter will come." The parrot repeated, "The hunter will come." Again and again, "The hunter will come. The hunter will come. He will cast a net. He will cast a net." That is the second lesson. The third lesson, he will strew some grains into that net. So he'll strew some grains into that net. He'll fold the net and carry you away. He'll fold the net and carry you away. So the parrot went on repeating these four lessons. The hunter will come, he'll cast the net, he'll strew some grains, he'll fold the net and carry you away. So the parrot very devotedly just repeated what he said. He learned by the rote, and every time it'll keep on repeating these lessons from the tree. And in due course, the holy man was apparently convinced that the parrot had learnt its lesson, and it would be able to save itself from the hunter. So one day he left his hermitage to go on alms. Until this parrot was able to master these lessons, he, out of consideration for life of the parrot, he had encased it in a cage. And that day, when he was convinced that the parrot had learnt its lessons, he let it free from the cage and let it perch on the branch of the tree. He thought the parrot would be able to take care of itself. And he went about his way for his alms. And that time a hunter came with his wares, net, grains and all that. And he saw, when he comes near this tree, he hears some mumbling from this parrot. And then when he heard intently, "The hunter will come. He'll cast a net, he'll strew some grains, and he will fold the net and take you away." So with a smile, he went about his job. He spread the net and threw some grains, and birds from nearby trees, they all came down and then pecked at the grains. And our own parrot was no exception. That also came down, pecked the grains, and then when they were busy pecking at these grains, the hunter carefully folded the net and made a bundle of it. He had a very good catch that day, which included our parrot, which had all these lessons from the holy man. And the parrot was repeating from inside the net, "The hunter will come, he will spread the net, throw some grains, fold the net, and take you away." This is what is called unassimilated education. We want assimilation. Swami Vivekananda says, we want man-making, character-making assimilation of ideas. If only the parrot had assimilated what the holy man had taught it, it wouldn't have left the perch in the first place. So it led an instinctive life, but it had the capacity to just repeat whatever you said. That is what is called dry scholarship. That is what is called scholarship without discrimination and devotion. Sri Ramakrishna made it a point to visit people endowed with scholarship, but he would make sure before going, if the pandit had only dry scholarship or was endowed with devotion and discrimination also. Pandit Shashadhar, you have a whole chapter dedicated to him. Pandit wishes to visit to Sri Ramakrishna, and Sri Ramakrishna's visit to this pandit. And you find the great master an additional piece of information which you don't find in the gospel. Swami Sharadananda says that this pandit was known for scholarship, his way of exposition and all that. But it didn't seem to have much of a transforming effect on his life. And Sri Ramakrishna heard about all this from his disciples, including Narendranath. And And you see what followed. Sri Ramakrishna went to see him and he gave such precious teachings to the Pandit. Did you receive any badge of authority? The Pandit said, I'm afraid, no. Then Sri Ramakrishna said, you don't, so people will listen to you for a couple of days and then go away. And Sri Ramakrishna says, strengthen yourself a little more by your spiritual practice. Then you grow in devotion and all that. And Sri Ramakrishna's holy company, this interaction, transformed the Pandit. He left all his lecturing, went to Varanasi, devoted himself totally to spiritual practice. You find this fact in the great master. You don't find it in the Pandit Shashadhar chapter in the Gospel. So Sri Ramakrishna was appreciative of this Pandit. He said this Pandit did not lack devotion. He did not lack discrimination. He had a little of that. That was evident by his receptivity to Sri Ramakrishna's teaching. Sri Ramakrishna said in a single meeting he became diluted. In Sri Ramakrishna's language, dilute means all his resistance inside melted and he was no more stubborn, there is no rigidity in him. He was receptive to Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. So that was Sri Ramakrishna's holy company which kindled spiritual aspiration, devotion in this Pandit. And he really turned within and turned towards spiritual practice. So scriptural teachings are to be assimilated. Some teachings which appeal to us, two teachings, three teachings, one teaching. Let's in our own humble way try to put it in practice. And we know how difficult it is to put into practice. But we try to do it. That is where Sri Ramakrishna's teaching of taking one step toward God comes in. I take one step toward God, but taking that one step involves struggle. But as I struggle, I understand that I am not alone in my struggle, and suddenly the struggle becomes a little easy. Not because of my own self-effort, but because God has started taking steps toward me. One step you take, God takes 100 steps, 10 steps toward you, or 100 steps according to another version. So scriptural teachings are to be followed, are to be assimilated. Third practice. Thus worship God. Tene shasya vidiyatam. So study of, Sri Shankara says, study the scriptures and thereby worship God. That means we convert this also into a spiritual practice. Once again, the idea that it is not for scholarship is driven up here. We look upon scriptural study as some kind of a knowledge sacrifice, jnana yajna. We find in the 4th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita how all of our activities can be converted into a sacrifice, yajna. Sacrifice in a yajna, in a fire ritual, in a havan, in a homa, we offer everything to the fire outside. Here we offer them all to the fire within. The Gita says breathing in, breathing out can be offered as a sacrifice. Self-control can be offered as a sacrifice. Sense control can be offered as a sacrifice. Scriptural studies can be offered as a sacrifice. So these are all offered as worship, offered as sacrifice to God. Our own spiritual practice, when we do our spiritual practice called upasana, at the end of it, we offer the fruits of our worship to God. We don't appropriate it to ourselves. We don't say, I've done spiritual practice for so many years, nothing seems to be happening. If nothing seems to be happening, I need to focus on my spiritual practice. So there's something wanting within me. But I don't try to be calculative. I offer that also to God. So there is a little element of selflessness in our spiritual practice also. Sri Shankara gives an example. This seems to be a little extreme. He says, to indicate this selflessness, lack of expectation, he says, one should stay clear of the expectation, stay clear even of the expectation that God is going to be pleased with my actions as Karma Yoga and bestow devotion and freedom on me. Even this expectation, stay clear of it. But God will not be found wanting. God will give. God will give us whatever is to be given to us. But let's not have that expectation. When we have expectation, we tend to have... We tend to worship Him more when what we expect is forthcoming, and when what we expect is not forthcoming, then that has a bearing on our devotion. So that is not having any expectation. It doesn't mean God will not give us. Here again, there is an important teaching of Swami Madhavanandaji, 9th president of our order. He says, remember always that God will not be a debtor. He will never owe us anything. We always owe God. He always ends up giving us much, much more than what we deserve. And what we have already deserved, we got to struggle hard and pray to God, do our spiritual practices, to earn the competency for what we've already received. So God will not be found wanting. So we don't need to have expectation, but whatever we need to get, we need to have, God will definitely give us that. So that we look upon our spiritual practice as, we look upon our scriptural studies as a spiritual practice and worship God through this. I think we'll conclude here. It's 8:50. We'll continue with the fourth teaching, fourth practice tomorrow. Jananim Sharadam Devim Ramakrishnam Jagadgurum Padapadme Tayo Shritva Pranamami Mohur Moho. We take refuge at the feet of Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi and Great Master Sri Ramakrishna. Our salutations to them over and over again. Om. Peace, peace, peace be unto us, peace be unto all.